thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
From the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University, this is Digital Campus, a biweekly discussion of how digital media and technology are affecting learning, teaching, and scholarship at colleges, universities, libraries, and museums.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Fear itself.
This is Digital Campus number 25 for the 21st of April, 2008. Get with the program. I'm Dan Cohen. And we're here for the 25th anniversary edition of the Digital Campus podcast. Here, as usual, with Tom Scheinfeld. Hi, Tom.
Hey, Dan.
And unfortunately, Mills Kelly could not make it today, but we are incredibly fortunate to have two really bright and creative individuals working in the digital humanities with us on the podcast, and we were just going to have them on the feature segment to talk about their thoughts on starting programming, but we've decided they're so good, we have to bring them in the new segment as well. So we have with us as well Steve Ramsey from the University of Nebraska. Hi, Steve.
Hello. Hello, everyone.
And Steve is an assistant professor of English at the University of Nebraska at Lincoln, and you're also a fellow at the Center for Digital Research in the Humanities. Do you want to say a word about the center?
It's a big research center, similar to the sort of outfit you guys have, or IATH, or MYTH, or other organizations, centers like that, and has about 40 or so digital projects, including the Whitman Archive, most famously, and some other things. And it's a really wonderfully vibrant research community. Was one of the main reasons I came here, actually, is to be associated with that group. So,
great. Yeah, we follow a lot of the work that goes on there. Steve, you can be found online at your blog, which is at lenz.unl.edu.
Yes.
And we are also fortunate to have with us, and I think this is the first time we've had a guest back. So, Bill, you've done a good job on, I think it was Digital Campus number 9, Bill Turkle from the Department of History at the University of Western Ontario. Hi, Bill.
Hey, guys.
And Bill, of course, is the mind behind digitalhistoryhacks.blogspot.com, one of the great digital humanities blogs out there on the web. And you're also an assistant professor in the Department of History at University of Western Ontario. And anything you would like to plug?
No.
Okay. Well, I know we have something else to plug from you, a book that you're working on later on in the feature segment. So we'll have ample time for plugging. But as usual, we'd like to dive right in the news, and it's great to have Steve and Bill joining Tom and me on the news roundup. Well, I guess one of the things that the four of us always deal with is our servers, our web servers, which are generally giant pains in the rear, and as our server has been doing a lot this past week, crashes a bit. And so I guess we always look at the attractiveness of maybe hosting off-site and putting our applications in better suited environments. And so I guess we were interested, at least Tom and I were, on the launch of Google Apps Engine, which is a place to put web applications where Google stores it. Tom, what was your initial thought on this? I know we host web applications like Omeka, the web exhibit software. Is this something that we would want to port over to Google Apps in the future?
Well, I should say off the bat that my feelings on this are a little bit colored by the week I've had, which has involved a lot of butting up against our administration and bureaucratic red tape in various ways. And so I'm right now, you're catching me at a moment when I'm incredibly eager to move all of our stuff off campus and to some, more reasonable site. So I do think it's a promising idea. The idea of having someone else host your web application, keep everything up and running, providing storage even is a really attractive one. Kind of outsourcing some of that, some of those functions and some of that work. We've talked about outsourcing other things on campus, more and more universities are turning to things like Gmail to outsource their email systems. And to some extent, you could see a similar model for outsourcing web applications that are built by and used by university and library and museum communities. So it sounds good to me. And I've noticed that people have been doing experiments combining some of these services so that Google hosts and runs the web app itself, but Amazon S3 provides the storage and various other things. So I think it's definitely something to consider.
Right. So a little bit more info on this, and then we'll get Bill and Steve's input on it. But it seems that, first of all, for those who don't know about sort of outsourcing these sorts of things, generally the way you do it is that you get a server, much like the one you currently have, which is a box connected to the internet 24/7, and you can write in files and create a database there and things like that. This is a sort of different environment. You don't really get access to all the stuff on the server. You don't get access to the operating system. You can't install a database. It's sort of what they call cloud computing, and you kind of have to program to that particular environment. So you have to kind of learn these things. I guess a good competitor is Amazon has some of these services, like their EC and S series. So S3 is a storage capacity that you can use for applications and dump files there. And a lot of modern web applications use Amazon services to host this. But it's not like you have access to your own server. And so some of the worries about this are that you're giving your application away to Google's giant server farm. The other thing is that Google, at least at first, is requiring you to program in Python. And Steve, you are an active Python programmer, is that correct?
Actually, Bill is the...
Bill, I'm sorry.
I know Python fairly well, but Bill is the expert. I'm more on the Ruby side.
Oh, you've gone to Ruby. Okay, we'll discuss this in a few minutes.
Right.
Bill, have you looked at Google Apps Engine at all? I mean, is this something you would consider, or do you just like the total control that you get of hosting something on your own server?
I'm actually of two minds about this. I think if you're trying to do the kinds of projects that you guys are doing, or that they're doing at Nebraska, where you're creating tools for other people or for a kind of community of users, then absolutely it seems to me to put the stuff on someone else's server and let them do the kind of low level sysadmin type stuff. In terms of kind of individuals or smaller projects or more kind of hackish projects, I think it is essential to get a setup where you can actually get under the hood and tinker around with stuff. And so I would say, there's kind of benefits to both approaches, definitely.
And I think that there could be, and Bill, even what you're describing, I think that there could be a hybrid model where the development of your project, even if it's a larger product or web service, that the development has to maybe happen on your own machine, so that you're on your own server, so that you really can have the full range of possibilities to experiment with. But once it's up and running, I mean, for dealing with all the issues of load and uptime and patching, security patches, and things like that, maybe outsourcing is a good option.
Yeah, definitely, Tom. And also, I find that just having a server is very useful for myself. Like, one of the things I've started doing recently is synchronizing my own personal files using a web server across my various Macs and PCs and Linux boxes that I have at home and at work.
Well, it does seem that one benefit is certainly if you don't have access to your own server, or your university doesn't provide something like that, the capacity on this Google service is pretty high. I mean, they estimate you can have a website with 5 million visitors a month and not go over their limits for the free service. So it's certainly something that I think we want to keep an eye on. And sort of one of these tech trends is this cloud computing environment. And I think Google entering this market really kind of provides some competition to Amazon as well, and I think makes it more attractive just in terms of worrying about hosting your own server, as we have, Tom, all week. So we'll keep an eye on that story. But another story is Over at the Library of Congress, something very different. We've got a lot of friends of the show over at the Library of Congress, and so we were interested to see the launch of My Library of Congress, which is at myloc.gov, sort of a cute name. Do we need myloc.gov? Well, we're not sure. Let's take a listen to their introductory video.
This is the $5 Confederate bill found in Abraham Lincoln's pockets on the night that he was assassinated.
These are the founding documents for the NAACP. This is the original yellow ribbon that was tied around the old oak tree during the Iran hostage crisis.
This is the sneeze that launched 1,000 film careers.
And you'll find them all here at the Library of Congress.
So it's, as Dick Clark used to say, it's got a good beat and you can dance to it. I guess the question here for listeners in the audience is, how much a website like a collection like the Library of Congress or an online archive in 2008, do these sorts of sites need services like MyLOC provides? Particularly, they have a sign-in where you then can create your LOC. In other words, you can grab objects or lesson plans or videos from the Library of Congress website and sort of store them in your own personal online book bag. Well, I have pretty strong views about this, but I won't say. Maybe, Steve, what are your thoughts on this? Do you think collections like, let's say, the Whitman Archive, is there a way to for users to sign in and have their own My Whitman?
I don't know. I mean, I don't know whether the you know what the LOC has done is good or bad or whatever. But there is it when I see someone put my before the name of a portal. On a website, it's always kind of a red flag, because I think that the great virtue of the web, or where the web really shines, is when it takes advantage or it adheres to Jacob Nielsen's observation that you have 8 seconds to do something interesting. Get in there quick. It's obvious what needs to be done. Things are very brief, and I can, move in a kind of fleet way. Often, and I don't think there's anything, teleological about this, or, I don't think it necessarily goes down this path, but often when websites start to talk about, well, why don't we have a My LOC, usually they run the risk of putting a whole bunch of sort of new kinds of interface constraints and a sort of like, now you have to learn a new system that is often a system different from the way the web normally works. And so there's always a big usability issue with these kind of moves on website portals. Right. So I don't know. Now, maybe they've done it brilliantly, but I can say that I think often when we go that way, Edward Tufte has this great thing where he says, it's a bad meeting when someone says we need a metaphor, right? So, you're in a design meeting and someone says we need a metaphor. there's great wisdom to that. And I think often what starts to sort of take over when people start designing portals is, we'll have a metaphor and it will be just like walking around the real library and all this kind of stuff. And maybe you'll have a bag and you can put books in a bag and things like that. And as we do this, we run the risk of getting further and further away from sort of the normal web conventions that people know how to use. So,
yeah. Well, speaking of portals, I mean, Bill, you're one of the prime movers behind Niche, the Networking Canadian History and Environment. And you've got a lot of, environmental data there, et cetera. Do you have meetings with metaphors, or how did you sort of conceptualize that and think about how people will then use that without having this kind of, my book bag metaphor or sort of ability to store this material on your web service?
Well, it's a good question, and it's one we certainly haven't really solved yet. I mean, one of the things that we have done is we've created a content management system with the idea that our various users and stakeholders would be able to have blogs, contribute to forums, exchange messages, that kind of thing, use tools. But it's really, I have a bit of sympathy for the people who say, you know what, we need a My Whatever, because at least their heart is in the right place. They're trying to reach out to the network society.
Yeah, I mean, I guess this is something we always talk about at the center in terms of, you know, I think, Tom, is Omeka going to have some kind of, you know, My Omeka plugin, or
it's going to be an optional plugin, and we are actively building it. So users of Omeka, institutions that choose to use Omeka to host their collections and their exhibitions, can install this My, we've gone around about names, My Archive, My Stuff, My Backpack, you know, all of these metaphors, and maybe I've fallen into Steve's trap here, but they'll have the option of installing this and allowing their users to do just this, to favorite items, to share items. They'll be able to build their own mini exhibits that they can, you know, especially for students who can build a little exhibit that they can email to their teachers.
Yeah, and I suspect that's what the main audience for this LOC site is, the students, and you know, clearly with the emphasis on lesson plans on the site. The ability to build up class galleries and things like that. Sorry.
Right, and I think in some ways those kinds of constraints that take you out of the normal conventions of the web and put you in a kind of a separate space are kind of useful for the classroom, because the classroom is sort of a separate space. It's constrained. It's not the research environment. It's a much more constrained environment. So maybe they're useful for that. At the same time, what we're doing with Omeka is everything in Omeka comes out of the box Zotero compatible. So you could also, if you don't want to organize your stuff on our web service, you could organize your stuff in your Zotero collection. So I think maybe the idea here is to give users options for how they want to maintain this information.
There's nothing, you know, I don't think there's anything inherently... It's just sort of a warning flag, like I said, right? It's like, as soon as you get into this, as soon as you start saying, I'm going to sequester a space for my users where they can do certain kind of things, which, as you say, might be exactly what is needed for something like a classroom, you know, when you're trying to have a classroom environment or something like that. But you immediately increase the number of things you can screw up in terms of usability, right? So that's really what it's about.
True.
And so you can do this kind of thing absolutely brilliantly. I hope the LOC has. I haven't looked at it, but it always to me signals like, okay, let's go slow here, you know, as we get into trying to create a useful, usable experience.
Well, I'm thrilled about this discussion, because we are working on the My Archive, My Stuff, whatever it is, plugin as we speak, and I'm going to take some of this away back to that development and think again about this.
As I said at the top of the podcast, we're incredibly lucky to have Steve and Bill here, because they are really two of the world's experts on humanities programming, and we wanted to have them on the podcast because for quite some time, Tom, I think you could agree, we've sort of wanted to have a podcast on, you know, how you get started with the more technical side of the digital realm in museums and libraries and academia. And Bill, maybe if I could start with you, you're actually writing a book called The Programming Historian. So could you tell us a little bit about that book and how you sort of approach this topic of someone who's totally new to the topic, who can't just wade right into algorithms and all this complicated stuff? How do you get them started?
Okay, well, what I'm working with a colleague, Alan McEachern, and what we're doing is we're kind of writing an work in progress, open access book that's a tutorial style introduction to programming. And our idea is kind of that maybe you're coming into this without knowing very much about, you're comfortable with computers, but maybe you don't know very much about programming. And so what we're trying to do is we're trying to come up with a set of lessons that teach you how to create some simple tools that help you get stuff off of the web and make use of it. And so right in the kind of introductory lessons, we have things on you know, installing the language and some simple programming tools. We have things on automatically opening and downloading and scraping material from web pages and computing word frequencies. Google searches and things like that. And really the goal is to try and create not just a useful tutorial, but to try and create a small community of people who think of themselves as humanists or as historians who know how to program, basically, and who for whom that's part of their way of looking at the world.
So, Bill, your method then is actually to sort of start with something that all these historians know, which is the web. I mean, a sort of experience that they're used to, and then to kind of build off of that. Is that right? By doing things like web scraping.
Yeah, absolutely. And to not just their experience with the web, but their experience with the kind of useful tools like Zotero that and RSS feeds, the kinds of things that they probably, if they're not already using, they want to start using right away. And so we're trying to, and one of the things that's really interesting about this project so far is my co-author actually doesn't know anything about programming. I mean, he's starting to learn about programming, and so this is really a conversation between the two of us and between the people who have started reviewing the material that we have online about, you know, what do you need to know? How much do you need to know? How do you get started? What's clear? What's right. not clear?
Right, right. Well, Steve, you know, normally the way that, you know, beginning computer or programming classes begin is, you know, you start with a language and you start with some basic symbols and constructs and kind of get more complicated from there. Should things be different for humanities scholars? Is there a different approach that you take, for instance, when you've taught it in the class?
I don't know that there's a different... I spend a lot of time getting people over their fear of computing and their fear of that this is all going to be, you know, way over their heads and so forth. And so I do a lot of pep talks about what we're doing. but I guess the other difference is that I tend to emphasize words and text in all the sort of problems and examples. In a traditional sort of computer science curriculum, you know, the first thing you'd be doing is, you know, using the program, whatever programming language they're teaching to, you know, generate the Fibonacci sequence or something like that. I start with things like Mad Libs programs, right? you know, I do a lot of stuff with text and a lot of stuff with, now, you know, this is ironic because actually text or strings, as we say in programming, are, I think on balance actually harder to deal with than numbers in many ways. But I think that the students, you know, it helps them to feel more comfortable with the material right away. You know, they know text, they feel comfortable in that land. And so it's easier for them to get into it. But, you know, at some level, the way I teach programming, you know, from, as you say, from first principles, really isn't all that different from the way it's taught, you know, in an ordinary computer science program, I think.
Steve, do you have a particular language that you stick with or that you force on students?
You know, it's funny. I get asked, you know, I remember when I, when I started in programming, I was obsessed with the question of what language should I learn? You know, where should I start? What language should I learn? I remember I went and asked a friend of mine who was at the time doing a PhD in computer science and who was also, a good old fashioned hacker. And I said, so what language should I learn? And he said, oh, it doesn't matter. Just pick one. You know, whatever. he said, oh, you know what? There's some great pseudo languages out there, like pseudocode. There's, you know, you can go get a book on a language that doesn't actually exist, but, you know, will teach you programming. I thought he was, you know, 100% out of his mind. I mean, I thought this guy was now on the 131st floor of the ivory tower. This was so divorced from reality. You know, now it's been, you know, 12 years or so since that conversation. And I now see that he was 100% right. And he was right in the sense that what's important about programming or what needs to be learned is this set of fundamental concepts. And that set of fundamental concepts really doesn't change from language to language. And so, which is why, you know, I probably know 10 different programming languages, and I think Bill probably does as well. mostly because those, since the concepts don't change. What I tell my students is that the first language is hard because programming is hard. The second language is hard because it's not like the first language. And after that, you pick them up in a weekend. Now, having said all that, that it's the concepts that matter. If you're starting out today, you have great choices because you have languages like Python, which Bill is an expert on Python. You have languages like Ruby, which is a language that I teach. And, the great advantages of these languages, I think, is that they take you away from some of the sort of low-level concerns of languages like systems programming languages like C and C++ and things like that, and allow you to get right in and write useful programs fairly early in the process. And so I think for anyone who's starting out today, that's the way you want to go, is towards those languages like Ruby or Python or even Perl or PHP, languages like these. And I would say that I write in pretty regularly in maybe half a dozen different languages, but in terms of teaching, I've stuck with Ruby for a number of years, precisely because it's so easy to get into it so quickly and to learn those fundamental concepts that, again, are going to be portable when you go try to learn some other language.
Bill, what do you have a real preference for Python, or is there a reason? Do you generally agree with what Steve just said about not really having to choose a language?
I think, I do generally agree with Steve. I mean, I think the thing is that at the beginning, it does make sense to start with a high-level scripting language like Python or Ruby or one of those languages, just because it makes a lot of tasks easier, and there are a lot less kind of hardware issues that you have to be concerned with. But over time, I think that you kind of, especially if you do work on the web, you kind of have to take what Manan Ahmed called the polyglot approach. You have to be comfortable moving between PHP and Python and JavaScript and HTML and XML and whatever else you're using, just because other people are programming in all of these different languages or scripting in all of these different languages. Well, but it definitely doesn't hurt to kind of start with one of the high-level ones and work out.
I mean, I think, speaking to, Bill mentioned, and he and I think are in agreement about this as a teaching modality, is that we both try to connect things right away to, what would a historian want to do with the web or with this data set or whatever? What would a literary critic want to do with this text collection? And we try to sort of get into that as quickly as we can. And these languages, they're sometimes called scripting languages, are very good at letting you get right in there. The problem with some the first language I learned was C, which was an extraordinarily bad language to start with. And it, in part because C makes you worry about things like, memory management and all of this kind of stuff. Now, one should probably, eventually go back and learn all of that kind of stuff. But in the beginning, with these dynamic languages, we have the great advantage of being able to build useful programs right away. I think that's another pedagogical issue, is that the only way to learn programming is to write programs, and the more real those programs are, the better. If you have the ideal situation is you have something you need, something you want, some tool that would make your life easier, and you're locked in a room and you have to figure out how to build that tool. That's maybe the absolute best way to learn how to program. And in fact, all of the exercises that I do in my class are in a sense an attempt to recreate that, artificially create that those conditions, right? So that that students get into it. But again, these high level languages, you can fairly quickly get into writing, real useful programs, and that's just such a huge advantage, right? I think if in a class on C, say, you could be there for, you could be in that class for a month and a half before you write anything that looks like a real program, right? Whereas with Python, we can have you in a couple weeks, you're writing stuff that's potentially useful to you.
One question I have for you guys is, who do you think needs to know this? Like, we're teaching students how to program. We're writing books to help historians learn how to program. I mean, who needs to know this? Presumably, or maybe this is wrong. Presumably, not the whole community of historians and humanists needs to know how to program. But who does? I was at a meeting a couple of weeks ago with a group of librarians, archivists, and museum professionals, all discussing the future of training for their professions and issues of mutual concern thereof. And one of the questions that came up was, do we need to be training our, you know, MLS students how to program, and do they need to know any computer languages? And that was, a lot of people were saying, oh no, they don't need to know this. They just need to be technically literate, whatever that means. And I think I was sort of in the second camp. There were a bunch of people saying, well, they probably need to know a little. If we do want to train leaders for this new information and digital information age, they maybe need to know a little bit of programming. The exercise that I wanted to go through was to have everyone in the room raise their hand if they knew a little bit of programming. And pretty much, I think everybody in the room would have raised their hand. And if those are leaders in the field and they all know a little programming, why don't our students need to know as well? But what's your take on that? I mean, is this something that we all need to know, or is this just something that, you know, maybe the few people who work in a center like yours, Steve, or a center like ours, Dan, is this something that just we need to know?
Tom, my feeling is that this network really lies in diversity. And so the key point for me really is that some people have to know how to do this, and some of them have to know how to do it really well. And there's not a sense in which kind of the whole historical profession can say, we're never going to need to know this, and our students are never going to need to know this. But on the other hand, I guess I don't feel strongly about kind of any imperial projects. And so I think it's probably okay for some people not to know it, as long as they know that they don't know it, if you know what I mean.
I think I would, you know, I would agree, first of all, that, I mean, you know, Bill and I are specialists, and I wouldn't suggest that everyone become a specialist any more than I would say, you know, everyone should become an American historian or a specialist in 18th century literature or something like that. But I would, you know, I can put this in positive terms by saying that I think that, or the experience that I had learning to program was really quite profound for me, because it was, what it represented for me was, for the first time in my life, I suddenly had control over this machinery on my desk. I see this thing happen all the time where people, they're working away in Microsoft Word or something, and the machine freezes and they hit the reset button and restart the system. And I think to myself, you know, if your dishwasher did that, you'd throw a fit, right? You'd throw it out the window. You'd be furious. You know, you would immediately say, what's wrong with this machine? Why isn't it working? And yet I see people with computers sort of feel like, well, it's a computer and it's a very complex thing, and who knows why it crashed, but I'll just sort of go along with it. It's hard to think that way after you learn to program. I think after you learn to program, you say, no, wait a minute, I'm not at the mercy of this bloody thing. Because what programming really gives you is the ability to change your environment, change your digital environment, you know, build it, hack it, break the warranty, et cetera, right? And I know for my students, certainly for me, that was a huge epiphany. And I think it is for my students too. You can tell that they take a different attitude. Like the digital world, if we can make a grand gesture like that, suddenly seems less intimidating and less deterministic than it might have before, because they suddenly realize that, well, no, I can have a role in how these things work, and I can change the way they work if they don't work the way I want. And so to that extent, I feel like everyone should learn how to program at least enough to have that sense, right? To have a glimpse of that sense of control over the environment, and to feel like, enough to help them to, you know, understand how these things work and so forth. Because I do think it's empowering.
I think that's a great point. Bill, how do you, I'm often asked what the difference is between learning a programming language or learning programming in general and learning a foreign language. So for instance, and I think this relates to what we were just discussing, that, you know, do you have to know ancient Greek to be a classicist, for instance? It gets back to this question. How are you in The Programming Historian, your book, how are you sort of answering that question about, you know, the differences, if there are any, between sort of learning a programming language and learning a foreign language? Is it in approach? Is it in results? How would you kind of address that question?
I think I would say that learning to program is a lot like learning a foreign language in a variety of ways. I mean, one of the ways is that you're kind of, a beginning programmer is kind of dropped into a culture where most of the conversation is something that they can't understand. They gain mastery, they have a sense that when they can read code, they've really arrived, but actually it's much more difficult to kind of fluently speak code than it is to understand something someone else has written. And so there's this kind of long process of basically learning to speak like a native speaker, and that's exactly sort of what beginning programmers are faced with.
Right. Steve, how would you answer that question? Someone came to you and, like you said, you know, maybe they don't want to be an Americanist, maybe they want to study French literature. Is it like learning French extremely well and that becoming fluid in another culture as well as language?
Yeah, I think there's actually, I find programming languages personally to be quite a bit easier than learning foreign languages, mostly because programming languages are, you know, rigidly consistent and predictable in a way that Attic Greek is not. But there are other, one of the big points of comparison, you know, shows up in the learning process, and that is that I know every foreign language I've ever studied has made me feel very stupid for a very long time. I remember sitting in classes on Greek and Latin and French and you sort of you have to get comfortable with your own your own daftness, as you struggle into this language. And learning programming is similar. It can be a little frustrating, and it's a very foreign way of thinking, and it requires certain habits of mind that you don't necessarily have. And, you know, I always have this experience with my students. You know, about 3 weeks into the class, I can see that morale is starting to dip, you know, because the stuff is getting hard, and they're, you know, it's frustrating and so forth. And what I usually tell them is that, you know, well, you know, I've been doing this for 10 or 12 years, and I can tell you that feeling will never really go away. and it will never go away, in part because you're always sort of trying to, you're always trying to pitch yourself slightly higher than what you're qualified to really do as a programmer. You know, you're always sort of struggling. At the three week mark, they're feeling very frustrated, but at the 8 week mark, they've suddenly become very comfortable with this mode of sort of instead of seeing it as frustrating, they've started to see it as a kind of fun journey of exploration and so forth. So I may be straining this comparison a little bit, but I think that there's a sense in which the comfort, like getting into the comfort zone as a learner of a foreign language, is very, very similar to getting into the comfort zone as someone trying to learn how to program.
Well, thank you very much to the both of you for this really fascinating discussion. And we'll look forward to reading The Programming Historian. And also, Steve, you said you have a book coming out on mathematics in the humanities. Do you want to mention that?
I guess next year from Oxford, I'm co-authoring a book with Patrick Eula at Duquesne University on mathematics for the humanist scholar. So this is a book that's really about certain kinds of activities in digital humanities, in particular text analysis, the sort of stuff that I do, requires some fairly heavy duty mathematics. And so this is an attempt to explain that world to humanist scholars. So,
sounds great. Well, you know that I'm very interested in mathematics, and I'm looking forward to that book. And Bill, if it's okay with you, we'll go ahead and link to your book in progress from the Digital Campus website.
Absolutely.
Terrific.
A book which is dynamite, let me say, as a fellow programming teacher. It's really excellent.
Thank you.
It's time for Picks of the Week. And Tom, why don't we start with you?
All right. I've got a kind of a cool little tool, actually an extension to the Mozilla Thunderbird email client. Mozilla, for people who don't know, is the foundation corporation that makes the Firefox web browser. They also have a great email client, a replacement for your Outlook or for your Apple Mail, called Thunderbird. And the Simile project at MIT has come out with a new tool called Seek. And what Seek does is it's a little plugin, a little extension for the Mozilla Thunderbird client that adds a faceted browsing pane to your email display. And if, for people who don't know what faceted browsing is, it's kind of like when you go to Amazon and it allows you to, you know, you do a search and then you can, you know, you do a search for something and then it shows you, okay, well, there are books, home and garden items, music, various things, and you can, and it kind of limits that search, so then you can click on music and it just gives you the things that hit on your search that are in the music category, and from there you can click on rock and pop and classical, and then you can, so you can limit, you can kind of limit your search down that way. iTunes has a faceted browsing panel as well. It's a really nice way to search. It's kind of a very intuitive way to kind of sort through your email. And the implementation that Simile has come up with in the Seek extension is really great. Our producer here, Ken Albers, had it installed on his machine, and he showed me it. And I haven't used it myself yet, but it looks very cool. And I encourage people to take a look and try it out and let us know what you think.
Sounds great. Bill, maybe could I go with you next?
Sure, yeah. Actually, I guess my pick would be a book that O'Reilly published last year, an edited collection called Beautiful Code. And it's a number of programmers discuss unusual problems that they faced and kind of how they solved them. And it ranges from some of the kind of programming giants, people like Brian Kernighan or John Bentley, to people who are really active now. And I think one of the things that's really interesting about this book is that it kind of goes beyond what we've said today, in that it shows you that sometimes thinking in different languages is a part of the approach to particular problems. And so I think it's good for people who want to go a bit further.
Sounds great. Thanks very much. I'll have to pick a copy of that up. I haven't read it yet. Steve, why don't we go over to you? What do you have for us?
Well, I recently became aware that that many of my colleagues in digital humanities, many of which are managing software or web development projects of one kind or another, are not familiar with maybe the most famous book ever written about software project management, and that's a book called The Mythical Man Month by Frederick Brooks. This book is now, I think, 30 years old. It was written by this guy Frederick Brooks, who was responsible for developing the OS 360 from IBM. So this is going back quite a few years. And The Mythical Man Month is about why that is about the failure of that project and how why it was such a disaster. It's been said many times that the many books that have been written on software project management are really just footnotes to The Mythical Man Month, in the same way that all philosophy is footnotes to Plato. And it's not a technical book at all. It's a book about the sort of sociology of developing projects that I think is still relevant today. So I feel compelled to make sure that people know about this book. And I'll also just mention its most famous quote, which is about the title Mythical Man Month, comes from this sort of Tayloristic notion that you can define productivity in terms of man months. And he has a quote in there that says, you can't get a baby in 1 month from 9 women. You know, adding more people to a project doesn't necessarily make it go faster and things like that. It's a very, very bracing read for anybody who's developed or tried to develop software.
Yeah, it's a really important read, and I would encourage our audience to take a look at it. We didn't really discuss this in the feature segment, but programming is often, unlike humanities scholarship, it's often collaborative, and maybe we'll have to have both of you back on the podcast to discuss issues with collaboration and code. There are certainly a lot of issues there. Well, my quick pick for the week is a site called Social Explorer. It's at socialexplorer.com. And, of course, this and all the other links we just mentioned will be available on digitalcampus.tv for this episode, episode 25. And what's neat about Social Explorer is that they just added, this is an application that shows you a map of the United States, and you can overlay various demographic information. It does a really good job. I think it's a nice application for high school and college teachers and students to take a good sort of data mining approach to looking at American history. Well, the reason I'm highlighting it today is that they recently just added some new information. They've got now census reports going all the way back to, I think, 1790. And the data is a little bit sketchy here and there, but it used to be only modern 20th century data, but they now have historical information as well. And they've also got some interesting kind of breakouts about religion and race and all kinds of things. So over 3,000 different kinds of maps that you can overlay, and I think it's kind of an interesting way of getting your students into thinking about demographics and U.S. history. So that's, again, Social Explorer. Well, I think I can speak for Tom in thanking our guest today, Steve Ramsey from the University of Nebraska. Thanks so much, Steve.
It was a great pleasure. Thank you.
Hope we can have you back on again. And Bill Turkle from the University of Western Ontario. Thanks so much, Bill.
Yep, no problem. Always a pleasure.
We'll be sending you the trophy for the second appearance on Digital Campus. Thank you so much for coming back. Poor Bill, I think the first time you were on, you had a terrible cold, and we forced you to do it live in our office. We dragged you in. So I really appreciate you joining us. And we're looking forward to your book, The Programming Historian. We'll, again, link to that from digitalcampus.tv. And we, as always, encourage our audience to leave comments for Steve and Bill and Tom and I. And look forward to seeing you and hearing from you and talking again in 2 weeks on another episode of Digital Campus.
The only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
Please visit us online at digitalcampus.tv, where you can join in the discussion and let us know about stories and issues you would like us to cover on future episodes. Mike O'Malley wrote our theme music.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Fear itself.